Symposium West presents Session 17, Families of the Prophets, The Rest of the Story, a panel discussion with Todd Compton, Laura Compton, Dan Erickson, and Glenn Cornett.
Welcome to this session, which is titled Families of the Prophets, The Rest of the Story. And I came up with the idea to do this. I guess, first of all, I decided to take a look at the families of Wilford Woodruff. And I just, it was an internet thing. I got interviewed on a website. What was that, Times and Seasons? And we talked about how these church priesthood Relief Society manuals, how it's so problematic that they have so much attention on the prophet himself, and then we're supposedly such a family-oriented church, and then they don't talk about his, his families. And, of course, the early church leaders were polygamists. And what also is kind of troubling is the fact that they kind of, in a implicit way, portray these early church leaders as monogamous. In other words, they emphasize the first wives and then they act like the other wives never happened. And sometimes they even don't even emphasize the first wife much. And that seems to be a contradiction to our idea of a family-centered church. You know, the most important work we do is the work in the home. And I understand that someone who worked on those manuals told me that certain elements in the group really strongly advised them to include these, you know, even if in just in a small way, to include recognition of these families of the prophets. And the other voices prevailed. And after the first one, the Brigham Young manual, these manuals were criticized publicly in the news media. And so it was interesting to see what would happen in the next one. And the next one, I think it was the Joseph F. Smith manual, they did mention that he had plural wives, but they said his plural wives will not be mentioned. And so when the Wilford Woodruff manual came out this year, we talked a little bit about it on the internet. You know, how about it kind of like creates a big problem when they don't even mention his plural wives, and or even mention that he was a polygamist. And so I thought it might be useful to put something on my website that would give an overview of Wilford Woodruff's plural wives. And so I thought, well, yes?
Turn that speaker up, or is it even working?
It isn't working. I mean, it's just for recording. So I'll try to speak louder. Sorry. Oh, the fan. Yeah, sorry. I'll try to speak a little louder. So I thought it would be easy, and we have a great biography of Wilford Woodruff, and it's by Thomas Alexander, Things in Heaven and in Earth. He spends a lot of time looking at Wilford Woodruff's families. However, he does not have a list at the end of the book where he lists all of Wilford Woodruff's families. And so I looked at other sources, and you find, 19th century sources that print the wives of the church leaders, like the big book, Pioneers and Prominent Men of Utah, and those wonderful Daughters of the Utah Pioneer books like Heartthrobs of the West and Treasures in Pioneer History. Often those have really good information on polygamous wives. And Mike Quinn's books, at the end of the two hierarchy volumes, he has really good lists of the plural wives of the church leaders. And so I looked at all those. Unfortunately, Quinn does not footnote those lists at the end of his books. So when I came up with my list of Wilford Woodruff's wives, I found a lot more questions than I would have expected. But and I was not able to do original research. I wasn't in Salt Lake. I couldn't go to the church archives. And so, Wilford Woodruff is not my research subject. You know, this was just kind of, I thought would be a simple little thing to do, and it was more difficult to do than I expected. But it does give an idea of Wilford Woodruff's plural families. And then when Sunstone came along, I thought it would really be interesting to look at some of the other church leaders who had been in some of these church manuals and look at their families and see what kind of polygamous families they had. And so I asked my wife to do John Taylor, and she accepted. And I asked Dan Erickson to do Heber J. Grant. And so I'm looking forward to see what they have to say. I asked Glenn Cornett to do Joseph F. Smith, but he was ill, so he couldn't make it. So I'm going to say just a little bit about Joseph F. Smith, because I actually have pictures of his wives, so I'll say a little bit about them. But I basically, you know, put it all together last night, you know. So I'm definitely not a original scholar on Joseph F. Smith or Wilford Woodruff. But it has been a wonderful education to me. I've learned a lot, and I've really enjoyed it. And so I'm going to dive into Wilford Woodruff, and we'll take these in chronological order, okay? Wilford Woodruff was born March. I asked my wife and friend Dan. Basically all I said was list the families, you know, list the plural wives, and then tell any interesting stories you come across. So that was the scholarly framework they're supposed to work with, and I didn't give them a whole lot of time to put these together. So once again, they couldn't make research trips to Salt Lake, but it will give you an idea what kind of families these men had. Okay, Wilford Woodruff, born March 1st, 1807. And he did not marry until April 13th, 1837. Okay.
Louder.
Okay. He did not marry until April 13th, 1837. Why is just those two dates, why is that kind of rare among Mormon culture at that time, or even American culture at that time? He married quite late, okay? You know, even in the Mormon singles board milieu, that's a bit late, you know, for some people. So he married Phoebe Whittemore Carter as his first wife, and she was also 30. And they had a number of kids, and prominent among them is Phoebe Amelia Woodruff, and she later became a plural wife of Apostle Lorenzo Snow, later became president of the church. So all through the history of polygamy, you find these dynastic alliances, connections between church leaders through polygamy. Okay, so Phoebe offers a really interesting case history of a first wife, and that's a role that had advantages and disadvantages. And Alexander wrote that in the 1870s, Wilford and Phoebe became less intimate. Increasingly, she and Wilford lived parallel lives, residing in the same house but moving on separate courses. Phoebe had become a community leader in her own right. She became a leader in promoting women's political activity, writing on one occasion that she would as soon think of neglecting her prayers as neglecting to go to the polls. I like that phrase. As Wilford and Phoebe, I'm still quoting Alexander, as Wilford and Phoebe grew more independent, Wilford's interest in providing for his younger wives and their children and in developing business operations with his older sons led him to engage less than previously in ventures involving Phoebe. Phoebe may have become more distant from her husband because of her swelling dislike of polygamy, and she may have harbored some resentment over Wilford's increasing attention to his younger wives and their minor children. And I don't know what Alexander's evidence for that is. I haven't found it yet. She once publicly observed that she thought it, plural marriage, the most heinous thing I ever heard of until she became convinced of its divinity. In private, she may have found the institution an unclean thing, yet she realized that in her position, She could not oppose her husband and other church leaders on the issue. Still quoting Alexander, although their relationship changed, Woodruff neither ignored Phoebe nor left her entirely to her own devices. As his first wife, she still occupied the primary position in his families. She remained publicly his most visible wife. They went to the theater and traveled together on occasion. So, especially, you know, in the 1870s and 1880s, if you were the first wife, you could travel with the husband, you could go to public places with him, where second, third, fourth wives often couldn't do that publicly. Okay, the next two wives are Mary Ann Jackson and Mary Carolyn Barton. And Woodruff married them possibly August 2nd, 1846, in winter quarters. And Mary Ann was 28, and Alexander refers to Mary Carolyn Barton as a teenager. And let's see, how old was Woodruff at this time? He was about 40. Okay. And both marriages lasted only about 4 weeks. And we're not exactly sure what went on, but we have some hints. And one of my ancestors figures in this story. And apparently, these young women, after they married Wilford Woodruff, began to keep company with some young men in winter quarters. And there's some hint that Wilford Woodruff thought that there was some impropriety that went on. And so he sent them back to, he sent one back to her family, and the other he sent to another family. And there was a divorce. And however, the young men who were involved received whippings. And I ran across the story of these whippings in the Hosea Stout journals. And Hosea Stout, he talks about one of the young men kind of took it like a, took it courageously, and the other one tried to run away. And but he says at one point one of the young men said, "Marshal Eldridge, you know, no more." And all of a sudden I realized this was my great-great-grandfather, Horace Eldridge. He was doing the whipping there at winter quarters. Okay, so here were two marriages that did not work out. And I think it's possible that, as often happened when, well, this polygamy was very new, it's possible that these young women did not understand that this was a marriage that would last through their life. They might not have understood that it was more than a ceremonial thing. But we don't have their accounts of what happened, so we're kind of guessing at that point. But they were younger, and the marriages only lasted about 4 weeks. Now, I take that back. This is Mary Carolyn Barton and Sarah Eleanor Brown. Those are the two women I'm talking about. There was one woman before them named Mary Ann Jackson, and she was not one of these two women who were keeping company. However, she also received a divorce from Wilford Woodruff, and we don't know the reason for that. So Wilford Woodruff's first three plural wives ended in divorce. It's interesting, though, Mary Ann Jackson, even though Alexander says she received a divorce, she seemed to remain in Woodruff's family. Somehow, he continued to care for her, and he even says that she was married again at some point, but she still seemed to have a connection with Wilford Woodruff. Okay, his next wife was named Mary Giles Meeks Webster, and he married her in 1852 in Utah, and Woodruff was 45 and she was 48. And they were only married about half a year, and then she died. Okay, so at this point, he has no practical plural wives yet. So then he married a woman named Clarissa Hardy, and Quinn lists her in his list, but I found no primary evidence for her yet. So I'm still looking for primary evidence. I think I'll probably find it, but we don't know a lot more about her, and so probably she was divorced from Woodruff, too. Okay, so we have, what, five plural wives at this point, and one died, but the rest apparently separated from Woodruff. The next wife is Emma Smoot Smith, and they were married in 1853. She was 15. Wilford Woodruff was 46. And I think this is an important pattern, marrying very young teenage women. And this started in Nauvoo with Joseph Smith. He married a 14-year-old. And it's a pattern that we see through the history of polygamy. And I think it's a problem pattern. But we do see it in these early church leaders. However, Alexander writes, Woodruff probably refrained from sexual relations with Emma until she became older, since she did not bear her first child, Hiram Smith Woodruff, until October 4th, 1857, 7 months after she turned 19. So I've also found this pattern in early Mormonism where someone, I think John D. Lee did the same thing. He married a 15-year-old, but there were no kids until the young woman was 18 or 19. And Emma Smoot Smith was the sister of Abraham Smoot, who was the famous stake president in Provo, father of Reed Smoot. And she became the mother of Abraham Owen Woodruff, who became an apostle, was an important apostle in the manifesto period. And after Phoebe's death in 1885, Emma became Wilford's public wife. And so she was able to go places with him, travel with him, with no problem. Wife number eight is Sarah Brown. Marriage date was 1853. She was 19. Wilford was 46. I don't know that much about her. She had eight children. Next wife, number nine, Sarah Delight Stocking. And she was known as Delight, I guess to keep her separate, to keep track of her as opposed to Sarah Brown. And marriage date was July 31st, 1857. And she was 19. Wilford Woodruff was 50. And they had seven children. She died May 29th, 1906 in Salt Lake City. The last wife, depending on what scholars you, according to Tom Alexander, the last wife was Eudora Levina Young Dunford, and she was known as Dora Lou. She was a daughter of Brigham Young. And this is a pure dynastic marriage linking the two general authorities. The marriage date was March 10th, 1887, and Eudora was 25, Woodruff was 70. And daughter of Brigham Young, Lucy Bigelow, thus she was the sister of Susa Young Gates. And she'd previously married Moreland Dunford, with whom she had two children, but this marriage ended in a divorce. And Alexander, Woodruff had just had a kind of a important revelation at this point that he shared with Brigham Young in the St. George Temple. And Brigham Young was very impressed with it. And, quote, obviously enthused by the festivities in St. George and convinced of the divinity of Woodruff's revelation, Young offered the apostle his 25-year-old, recently divorced daughter, Eudora Levina, as an additional wife. They had one child and who died soon after birth. Then there was a divorce. And so there was this danger with these dynastic marriages that they didn't have a strong emotional bond between them. And also, you can see there's a big disparity in ages there, too, isn't there? Okay, and Eudora went on to marry a non-Mormon judge, Albert Hagen, had four children with him. She died in Nevada on November 12th, 1922. Okay, according to some sources in the Mormon record that don't, according to some sources, Wilford Woodruff married a woman after the manifesto named Lydia Mary Olive von Finkelstein Mamrioff Mountford. And she was a very, very dramatic woman. She would go around lecturing, and she would dress in the costumes of the Holy Land. She lectured on the Holy Land. And she came to Salt Lake, and she lectured there, and Wilford Woodruff was very taken with her, and they became close friends. And Mike Quinn and Carmen Hardy, who wrote two of the classic works on post-manifesto polygamy, they both accept her as a wife of Wilford Woodruff that he married after the manifesto. However, Tom Alexander writes, "My own belief is that a marriage sealing of Woodruff and Mountford during Woodruff's lifetime did not take place, but that the two were good friends and admired each other. After Woodruff's death, there was a sealing in the temple after Woodruff's death." That's definite. Okay, but the marriage during Wilford's lifetime is not definite, and the Alexander, the biographer, rejects it. Okay, so... she was older. I have a picture of her later on, so when we go to the picture section, you'll see her. And again, because Alexander didn't accept her, I didn't do a lot of research on her. She had some association with the Holy Land. I think she was from the Holy Land at some point, or lived there. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Anne is telling us she wrote a couple books on the Holy Land, which she gave the titles of.
The story goes that they were married out at sea beyond the 3-mile limit.
Yeah. Yeah, the story is they were married out at sea beyond the 3-mile limit. So, as Nibley used to say to me, pay your money and take your choice. You can go with Quinn and Hardy, or you can go with Tom Alexander. Either way on that. Okay, here's my summary. Many of the standard patterns of Mormon polygamy are present in Woodruff's marriages. We find the phenomenon of favored wives and less favored wives. We have dynastic marriages where a young woman is used to bond to older elite men, and problems when a middle-aged or older man marries a teenager or young woman, often for religious or dynastic reasons. In the case of Mary Meeks Webster, we also have Woodruff marrying an older widow, probably to care for her. In the cases of Mary Caroline Barton and Sarah Eleanor Brown, it's possible that these teenagers did not fully understand that celestial marriage was applicable in this life, which is possible in Joseph Smith's marriage to Helen Mar Whitney. So Alexander summarizes Woodruff's family life. He did not treat his wives and children equally. He clearly preferred Phoebe and her children, and after her death, Emma and hers. He was much less involved with Sarah and least with Delight and her children. At least four of his marriages failed for reasons not entirely clear, but which included incompatibility in Mary Ann's case, perhaps his neglect in Eudora's case. Yet some of Woodruff's marriages, this is me talking now, were successful, fully successful. On his 91st birthday, he summarized his families with pride. March 1st, 1898, this is the birthday of myself and wife Emma. I have lived 91 years today, and my wife, Emma, 60 years. I have had to acknowledge the hand of God in the preservation of our lives until the present time. I did not deem it wisdom to have a birthday party today. Last year I met many thousands in the tabernacle, and Emma and myself shook hands with some 7,000 of the assembly, and I did not feel like going through that operation this season. Emma has lived with me as my wife 45 years. She has borne me 3 sons and 5 daughters. 1 son died in childhood. 2 sons grew to manhood, and both are noble men. And he goes on, he talks about his family. He talks about Asahel, one of his sons, and talks about his work in the church, which he's proud of. He talks about Abraham Owen and how he became an apostle. He is thoroughly fulfilling his mission as an apostle. Emma lost 1 daughter in childhood, but raised 4 to motherhood, all noble women. And he talks about Phoebe Carter, and he talks about Sarah Brown Woodruff. And you can see how proud he is of them. So I think this is an inspiring story, how he worked with his families and, you know, the real human story of how he had plural wives. And so I think it would have improved the church handbook to have some reflection of this in it. Thank you.
I'm going to have Todd do the driving on my PowerPoint here. And I apologize for my voice. If you can't hear me, please come closer. I was playing with Glenn Cornett, and he was too wimpy to get here, and I was here, and he was sick, and we're both sick, but that's okay. As the impetus for this, let me get out of the way. As the impetus for this was the church curricula, I took a look at the John Taylor program, the John Taylor manual, and at the front of the manual, they all include a historical summary of important events in the lives of the prophets. Of course, the marriage events were not important enough. The births of their children were not important enough. The deaths of their wives were not important enough to be included in the list of important events. So I took the historical summary from John Taylor's life and... sorry. And... He's...
I'm sorry, yes. We should have done this first. I'm sorry.
Sorry. that's what happens when you have a new baby distracting you. Yes. So this, I'm going to pass this around while I'm talking. The stuff that's in boldface is the stuff that I've added. The wives and the children are color-coded. So if you have a red wife, all of her children are in red, and you'll see that through. There are some notes. AF stands for ancestral file, so I got the dates from the church's ancestral file site. A lot of those have also been backed up by other places, so some of that information, it's not always really accurate. Some things are marked as Quinn, that is Quinn's hierarchy books. And there's a couple others. I think there's one from Sam Taylor's biography. Sam is the youngest child of John Taylor. And actually, I need my little... John Taylor and his last wife.
Yeah, his last son of John.
Yes, but he also had a son named John Taylor. Okay, so we have... when I agreed to do this, I thought that John Taylor had six or seven wives and that it would be a pretty easy job. Turns out he had nine others that nobody that I didn't know about. He had 34 natural children and one child that was adopted between him and another wife. Samuel, in his biography, notes that of John Taylor's sons, five of them were polygamous. So there were a bunch of others who never entered into polygamy, and six of them actually never married at all. Go ahead to the next. This is a list of John Taylor's wives. The asterisk information comes from Quinn's notes. It says wives were not necessarily recognized by traditional histories, but there is evidence of at least a ceremony, a sealing, a divorce, or sexual cohabitation. And we're going to go through each of these separately, so we don't have to spend a lot of time on this slide. This is a picture that was taken after everybody came to Utah of the seven wives that were regularly listed as John Taylor's wives. And this is the Gardo house where they kind of lived while John was running off in hiding. There was one interesting thing that I found at the Gardo house was that the mistress of the house was not one of John Taylor's wives. It was actually his sister, I believe. His first wife was Leonora Cannon. And Leonora and John were Methodists. Leonora was very interested in religion, and they both joined the church in Canada when John was kind of preaching there. There's a quote here that describes Leonora as being refined both by nature and education, gentle and ladylike in manner, witty, intelligent, gifted with rare conversational powers, possessed of a deep religious sentiment, and withal remarkable for the beauty of her person. She was a fitting companion to John Taylor. And Leonora was involved with polygamy all along the way. While John was on a mission to Great Britain, Leonora had to kind of live by herself and take care of things, and she had a little story that she wrote in her journal that said, she's talking about when he was coming, when he came back in July from his mission, and she said to him, she said that during his absence, I had gone through all but death, lived in an old barrack room 20 feet square with one small window, the back door off the hinges and the walls so open that a skunk came in every night. One winter, twice, I found a large snake in the room. Naturally nervous and timid, my sleep nearly left me. Twice when my children were sick and I had a light in the middle of the night, drunken Indians came to the door and they quarreled, some to get in, others keeping them back, and I alone with three small children. I had many privations and many mercies. I never saw one of Mr. Taylor's relatives in my house for the 2 years he was away. I was a stranger in a strange land without a friend or relative near me. My Heavenly Father, who has ever watched me, did not forsake me in the day of my adversity, but inclined the hearts of my neighbors to be kind to me, for which I give him thanks. And then her daughter Marianne got very sick and with a fever. And shortly, the daughter died in, she was born in June, and right before the birth, Leonora cut her finger and it got infected. The baby died just a few months later, and Leonora buried her finger with the baby. The finger was so bad it had to get removed. So she left her baby and her finger in Nauvoo before she came west. And then she had a story about when John Taylor was approached about polygamy, and he told this story a lot. He kind of was putting it off and wasn't really all that interested in it. Joseph Smith met him on the road and said to him, come on, you really got to get your act together. And John says, you know, he was a little, okay, I'll go do it. And so he went to talk to his wife. The kids went to bed. He came up to Leonora and said, you know, I really need to do this. We have to discuss this serious matter. And she said, okay, I know about it. And it surprised him. But she said that the wives of the 12 apostles had already been talking about this idea of plural marriage. And she was a little bit, I'm going to read a little bit from Sam Taylor's biography, which he says, turning sharply on him, she asked if he'd picked out his plural. She'd warned him right now that she wouldn't be a sister in the principal with some baby-faced tease, young enough to be her daughter, and without a brain in her silly head. No, that wasn't the type of wife he wanted, Taylor said. He admired women of mature culture and refinement. That's why he'd fallen in love with her in Toronto. During the time since Joseph had spoken about polygamy, John had been looking around and decided there was a young lady at Nauvoo who would make an excellent wife and also could be a sister in the principal to Leonora. Leonora asked if she knew the girl, and John said, yes, she's your cousin, Elizabeth. So go ahead. Elizabeth was from the Isle of Man, just as Leonora was, and she was older than Leonora. I mean, younger than Leonora by 15 years, I guess. And one fun story about Elizabeth. She was very accustomed to finer things, very refined and very, you know, she's not really fit for the pioneer lifestyle. And when Johnson's army started coming and the family had to evacuate Salt Lake City, Elizabeth was found scrubbing down her cottage floor. She couldn't stand to leave a dirty home, even if the soldiers were going to burn it down should the army show up. She had, when she was older, her son brought all their grandkids there, and just really, people thought of her as being, because of her attitude, they kind of thought, here it is. She was very precise and dignified, which perhaps caused some to think of her as being cool and stern, when in reality she was gracious and kind. She had three children, one daughter and two sons. Okay, we'll go to the next one. Next slide. Jane Ballantyne was 31 years old when she married, and Jane was one of two sisters. Jane and her sister Anne both married John Taylor. I didn't find a lot of stuff about Jane, but I did find a story about when they met Joseph Smith. And meeting Joseph Smith and kind of gave him an introduction and a reasoning into why they should believe him and why they should support this plural marriage. So the story about them meeting Joseph Smith is that they'd been on the boat and across the ocean, and then they'd come up the river, and Jane and Annie tidied their hair, donned gay bonnets with bright ribbons, and appeared in crisply starched ginghams. The family was excited and anxious. They had pulled up their roots, traveled thousands of miles for a new religion in which they had complete faith, and now they were to find out for themselves. As the boat pulled into the docks at Nauvoo, they were met by the prophet Joseph Smith, whom they thought was all and more than they had expected. He looked like a prophet, spoke like a prophet, and any apprehension in the minds of the Ballantyne family melted away. So they kind of were swept away by Joseph's, charisma, thank you. And there's not a lot, there's a little bit more, but let me go on. Next slide, please. This one, I like this story. Now, Anne Ballantyne didn't stay married very long. This is Jane's sister. John and Brigham kind of had a little tiff over this situation. Anne was kind of had caught both their eye, and shortly, let's see. Part of what was going on here is that there was this conflict in the quorum about who was going to be leading, who was going to be in charge. And Brigham Young was saying, it's time to get the first presidency going. And John Taylor and Orson Hyde were saying, you know, maybe we need to do things a little bit differently. And so shortly after this, Taylor was called to go on a mission to England. He'd be out of the way. And so right before they went to England, there was this party. And at the party, there was a dance. And everybody's kind of dancing, and John notices Anna, and Brigham notices this is Anna, and they get in a fight on the dance floor. And Sam Taylor says, while Pitt's band furnished the music for French Fours, Copenhagen Jigs, and Virginia Reels, a sudden commotion at the rear found Brigham Young and John Taylor locked in struggle. Taylor, being bigger, younger, and stronger, would have made short work of it, except that men leaped in to separate the pair. Standing aside from the fray was the toothsome cause of the conflict, pretty Anne Ballantyne, the very picture of lovely consternation. When after the scuffle she accepted Taylor's arm and whirled away with him and danced, Taylor realized that Brigham would not forget his public humiliation. And then after they got to Utah, they married in winter quarters. And after they got to Utah, they divorced. And Brigham Young granted the divorce, and there was a $10 service charge for four divorces, and Sam Taylor hints around that maybe Brigham Young pocketed that $10 himself just to kind of get back at John Taylor a little bit. Okay, go on to the next one. Mary Ann Oakley was there was a little bit more about her. She was a seamstress, and in addition to always looking her best and being very beautiful, she sewed a lot of clothes. And before her home was able to be built on Taylor Row in Salt Lake, she had to live with her sister down in Cottonwood. And while she was there, she did a lot of sewing, and she sewed Elizabeth's clothes and earned money sewing for other people. And she later had a cataract that covered one of her eyes for the last 20 years of her life. And some people think that it was because of all of her sewing that happened. Mary Ann had a bunch of kids, I think. I'm sorry. Go ahead to the next one. All my notes are on the computer. I didn't print them out, so I'm going to... Now, Mary Amanda Utley was one of another young woman who was married to John Taylor, and in January of 1846, John was sealed to like 10 women, and they were all at the Nauvoo Temple, and some of the information for these sealings is also, some of it we found in the Nauvoo Temple Endowment books. And the sealing records. And some indicate second anointings, and some indicate sealings. I haven't really distinguished here the difference because I did find other records. So sometimes I found just that they had a second anointing, which kind of indicated that they'd had a sealing done. And then I did find information about sealings. So Mary Amanda Utley was actually quite young, but she and another young woman that Taylor married didn't ever leave Nauvoo. They stayed in Nauvoo when the Saints went west, and I didn't find any other information about her. I don't know her death date. She never had any kids with John. And Sam Taylor speculates that perhaps they weren't really satisfied with their status as plural wives, as secret plural wives. And that perhaps that was why they didn't want to go west. It was not uncommon for plural wives to kind of decide mutually with the husbands, you know what, I'm going to stay here, you can go and do what you want. At least that's what I found. So next one. Next person is Mercy Rachel Fielding. Mary Fielding. This is Mary Fielding's sister. And Mary, of course, you know, was married to Hiram Smith. Mercy was married to Mr. Thompson, Robert Thompson, and had children with him. And then after he died, she married Hiram Smith. And then after Hiram's death, she was sealed to John Taylor for time, and she was sealed to Hiram Smith for eternity. So technically all of Thompson's kids would be sealed to Hiram, even though she had them with Thompson. So the interesting connection between Mercy and John Taylor is that they were both baptized by Parley P. Pratt at the same time. So they kind of knew each other, kind of coming through from Canada. Mercy always went by the name Thompson, even though she had been sealed to Smith and to Taylor. And she never had kids with John, and they later got divorced. I had one note there, and then go ahead to the next one. Mary Ramsbottom is the other one who was sealed young in Nauvoo and didn't leave the city at the same time as Utley. She was kind of in the same situation there. We'd go to the next one. Sarah Thornton was a case where she was a widow that John married to kind of take care of her and to take care of her family. She was married at the same time as a couple. While Taylor was gone on a 3-year mission, Sarah became acquainted with another person and fell in love with them. And while they were gone, when John came back, he agreed that it would be fine to divorce him and actually marry this woman this man that she knew and that she was in love with, rather than have John just, you know, taking care of her. And after his name was Prime Coleman. Oh, that was her first husband was Prime Coleman. She had some kids with him. Then she was married to John. And then Oh, well, it's right here on the slide. Sorry. So she was sealed to Prime for eternity, and married David Evans. David Evans is the man that she fell in love with while John was in England. Yeah, it really was, you know, finding this stuff out. Okay, Lydia Dibble Granger Smith was married to Oliver Granger. Go ahead to the next one. And Oliver, there's a lot of information about Oliver. There was a revelation, Doctrine and Covenants, about him. He kind of helped out in Kirtland a lot. And I couldn't find a lot of information about her, just about her husband and how he was a man of faith and really kind of took care of things and was really well thought of by Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith. And this was another case of John Taylor agreeing to marry somebody who needed to be taken care of. So after Lydia married Oliver, he died. She married Hiram Smith. And then after Hiram died, John agreed to marry her to kind of take care of her. Okay. So Anne Healing's Pitchforth, I like her story. She was a piano teacher, and when she came to Nauvoo, she taught piano, and she said, none of the pianos here are in tune. And John Taylor said, well, let's take care of that. Missionaries, when you go out, find a piano tuner, baptize him, bring him back to Zion. We need to have in-tune pianos. And so John Taylor got her this piano, and she wanted to take it with her, and when they came, and John said, well, are you sure you don't want to take the stove instead of the piano? And she says, man cannot live by bread alone. We're going to take the piano. So, of course, you know, the roads were really messy on the way to Iowa and going through Iowa, and it was all muddy, and the wagon tipped over, and she was riding in the wagon and almost was crushed, but they got her out in time, and the men were trying to get the piano upright again, and the front had popped off of it and was all full of mud, and it was kind of falling apart, and she looked at it, and she said, you know what, you guys, just leave it here, let it become part of the roadbed. And she was devastated that she had lost this beautiful piano. And John said, well, you know, when we get to California, because they thought they were going to California at the time, when we get to California, we'll have a piano shipped around the Horn, and that helped her feel a little bit better. But what really helped her feel the best was that night there was a big storm, and she helped Patty Sessions, who was delivering babies, and she was standing in the rain holding up horse blankets and canvas tarpaulins to protect these women who were giving birth in the rain and the storm. And she said, well, maybe having a broken piano isn't the worst thing in life. Giving birth in a rainstorm might be a little worse. Sophia Whitaker, go ahead, was another sister. He married a couple pairs of sisters, and this is another one. She was age 22 when John was 38 when they got married. And their official marriage date was en route from England to winter quarters, but nobody really knows exactly the date. And I think they were married by, as I recall, was Party Pratt. During her first pregnancy, she was in winter quarters, and she was a secret parole wife at that time. So she and another wife, Jane Ballantyne, actually, they had to kind of tell everybody, oh, well, we're really married to this guy who's off on a mission. They couldn't tell people that John Taylor was the father of their babies-to-be. And in Utah, this is another Johnson's Army story. We had the one where she was cleaning the house. And this one, she was 8 months pregnant, and it was cold. And they lived for several days. They found a cabin behind a friend's house where they were going to live. And they kind of got it all cleaned out. And they got moved in, and then they found out it was infested with bed bugs. And so they moved back out to the wagon while they tried to get rid of the bed bugs in the house. And the description of trying to get rid of the bed bugs I thought was really interesting, especially in light of the fact that we have all these hotels now that are having bed bug problems. So what they did was they scrubbed every crack and floor in the walls with coal oil. And then they set rocks around the floor. And on the rocks, they put pans smoldering with sulfur, pepper, tar, and horse manure. And then 2 days later, they moved in the house. So, you know, that's just a lovely way to spend your last month of pregnancy in a house that smells like burning manure. Okay, go to the next one. Harriet Whitaker was the daughter of, I mean, was the sister of our most other one. And their parents, their father joined the church in England, and he remarried while they were in England. And the daughters and some of their other siblings came with the father to England because the new wife, I mean, came with the father to America after joining the church because the new, her stepmother was very anti-Mormon, does not want to have anything to do with the religion. And one of the ways that Harriet provisioned herself was to take a bunch of the linens and the silver that she had brought with her from England. She traded it in for a wagon so that she could cross the plains. And then while she was going across the plains, kind of supporting herself because she didn't have a husband there helping her go across the plains, she burst a blood vessel and almost died. But she had some good care, and they went on. Okay, go ahead. Caroline Hooper Saunders was 39. John Taylor worked on a sugar train in Fort Leavenworth, and I haven't really done a lot of research on that. I'm not exactly sure what that's going on, but Caroline caught his eye. She was 39 years old and was very similar to his first wife, Leonora. Caroline actually left her first husband when he refused to join the church or to come with the saints, and so John Taylor thought that was pretty spunky of her and decided that they should go get married. And so they did, and they got married at Lumen Shirtless home. Okay, go ahead to the next one. Margaret Young. John, as many of you probably know, was involved with the newspapers in various places around the church. And his proposal to Margaret while they were in Connecticut was in the form of a love letter that he published openly in The Mormon, which was a little rag. It wasn't really a rag, but it was a little newspaper. And the love letter was called The Origin and Destiny of Woman. And it says, "Lady, whence comest thou, thine origin? What art thou doing here? Whither art thou going? And what is thy destiny? Knowest thou not that eternities ago thy spirit pure and holy dwelt in thy heavenly Father's bosom and in his presence, surrounded by thy brother and sister spirits of the spirit world among gods?" I don't know how that really sounds like a proposal, but apparently it was. Because shortly thereafter she was married, and she was the last official wife to marry John Taylor. She was the seventh one, and George Smith performed that ceremony. She was involved in she was the first counselor to the Young Women's MIA program. But after John Taylor died, she resigned those positions so that she could take care of her family. And she brought a bunch of books from Connecticut and stuff and made sure education was really important to her. And so her children were growing up and her grandchildren, she spent a lot of time making sure that they got educated. And go ahead. And this is the last one. Josephine Elizabeth. Her last name is French. I'm going to say it's Rocher. I have no idea if that's correct. But this is the largest gap. There's 50 years difference between John and Josephine. She was apparently very lovely, tall, slender, high-waisted, dark hair and eyes, serene and gentle temperament. Her nickname, she went by Neen. And this is another case where he proposed in writing, but this time it was a little bit more poetic. John moved into, this was, the marriage took place while John Taylor was in hiding. They were in Kaysville, Utah. John was living at Josephine's father's house. He was the mayor, and had quite he had the means to kind of help John. And after John had been there a month, he married Josephine. There's a little quote here that I wanted to read. Oh, I don't have it here. But the quote was about the fact that it kind of looked funny to have this young single nursemaid taking care of a man, so, and spending all her time with him. So we married her so that it would look better. Then, as John was getting tired and sick and older, and it wasn't much longer before he died, actually, from
6 weeks.
Yeah, and he felt bad because he really felt like polygamy was going to die. He saw all the pressure from the federal government, and everybody was in hiding and being arrested, and it was such an important principle to him, and he just felt devastated. And she comforted him, and she said that it was hard, but it was a sacrifice. And there were people in her generation, like herself, obviously, because she was entering into plural marriage, that were willing to do it and willing to make this sacrifice because they knew that it was a righteous thing to do. And she pointed out that people would continue to live polygamy despite the problems, just because it required dedication. But because it was required such dedication, it wasn't ever going to be for the masses. She was telling her husband that, you know, people will do it, they will continue to fight for it, but it will only be a select few who will do it. And Taylor said, one step backward now, and he was talking about the end of polygamy, one backward step now, and the time would come when the greatest enemy of the principle would be the church itself, unless Taylor could hold the line. So here he was at his dying day saying, kind of seeing how everything was going to be, and seeing that the church itself was going to be so, because of the way everything was going to happen, the church itself would be against the principle of polygamy. And it was just interesting to see how that has kind of changed, and it has kind of come true, despite the fact that so many have said, yeah, we're willing to make the sacrifice, and we're willing to work hard to make it work. One interesting note about Josephine. In 1921, so she was 50, 60 years old, she married another man named George Palmer. I don't know very much about that. But then she actually died in California. She died in San Jose, California, just down the road from where I live. But then she's buried in Kaysville. So that's all the information about their wives. I hope it was helpful.
We'll switch the chronology again and go to Heber J. Grant.
I guess.
I'm sorry.
I don't know. Daniel H. Wells, the man who replaced his father as Young's counselor in the First Presidency and one of his future father-in-laws, and to the immediate south lived Edward Hunter, who served as the church's presiding bishop for 32 years. At the Lion House, he was an often guest of his mother's friend, Eliza R. Snow, where he would hear stories about the life of Joseph Smith. Heber was always a serious youth, and while many of his generation found sport in renouncing polygamy, at the age of 19, Heber wrote and delivered a passionate defense of that institution. In November 1877, at the age of 20, Grant married his first wife, Lucy Stringham, a 19-year-old schoolteacher. Lucy's father, Bryant Stringham, like Heber's father, had arrived in the Salt Lake Valley with the original 1847 Vanguard Pioneers. Determined to be married in a temple, the young couple made the long journey to southern Utah. In St. George, they stayed at the home of Erastus Snow, who performed their marriage. Lucy's childhood was not an easy one, and later in life, she would express her appreciation for her family's abundance, juxtaposed to the poverty of her youth. Although the young Heber was already quite an entrepreneur at the time of their marriage, at the time of his marriage, he was in debt, and the newlyweds spent the first part of their marriage in Rachel Grant's small home. But it wasn't long before Heber's business acumen and connections began to pay off, including an 1877 appointment by Brigham Young as the church-owned Zion's Saving Bank's cashier. At the same time, Grant's church career was on fast track. In April 1880, at the age of 23, Heber began service as secretary to the new General Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association presidency, becoming associated with presidency members Wilford Woodruff, Joseph F. Smith, and Moses Thatcher. Later that year in October, just 8 days after Lucy and Heber's second daughter, Lucy, was born, as an outsider, the young Heber was called as the Tooele, Utah State President. Heber, Lucy, and their two daughters moved to Tooele in April 1881. Within a week of the move, the young Ludi, as she was called, came close to dying. Shortly thereafter, Lucy began a stomach illness that would plague her the rest of her life. Notwithstanding these personal difficulties, it is clear that the young couple's life was moving like a whirlwind when, in October 1882, less than 2 years after his call as Tooele State President, Heber was asked to attend a council meeting in Church President John Taylor's office, where Taylor announced a revelation, calling two new apostles, the 25-year-old Heber being one of them. An interesting side note is that Heber later learned that his name had previously been brought up in the quorum meetings, but that it had taken a written revelation to convince some of the wisdom of the selection. During Grant's tenure as state president, he kept two homes, one in Salt Lake, where he spent the week consumed with business affairs, and one in Tooele, where Lucy and the girls lived. With Grant's call to the apostleship, they moved permanently to Salt Lake, and over the next 5 years had three more daughters and a son were added to their family. Grant's church duties required traveling amongst the saints, and the Grant's third daughter, Florence, was born in February 1883 while Heber was serving a short mission in Arizona. At home, Heber and Lucy's children remember this as a time of physical plenty. A daughter recalled that, quote, "We had all seemed to have plenty of the necessities and comforts of life. There were men to milk the cows, take care of the grounds, and help around the house. Theater tickets were always available," end quote. Lucy appreciated Heber's ability to provide the family with fine clothes, beautiful furniture, and a Steinway piano. Having given birth to five daughters, Lucy finally gave birth to a son. However, after the young Heber was born, she was never physically well again. Due to Lucy's chronic illness, Heber's mother, Rachel, in her 60s and 70s, was often called upon to personally take care of the six children while Lucy was bedridden for months. Lucy's illness lasted for a decade, including a lengthy stay at St. Mary's Hospital in San Francisco. She died in 1893 at the young age of 35. Although a monogamous when he became a general authority in 1882, as a member of the 12, Grant was expected to live the higher law of plural marriage. Accordingly, in May 1884, over the span of 2 days, at the age of 28, Heber joined the polygamous ranks by marrying Augusta Winters and Emily Wells. As a pluralist, the next 2 days would prove to be a trying time for Heber and his three families. Grant admitted that living plural marriage, even in the best of times, was a difficult challenge, and for Mormon polygamists, the 1880s and 1890s certainly was not the best of times. The federal government was cracking down on both the Mormon church and individual polygamists, and Heber was forced to keep his marriage a secret and to separate himself from his plural families, sometimes for a month at a time. But in the late 1880s, Grant was in a unique position, safe from prosecution. His plural wives, not publicly known, he was one of only four of the apostles able to bear to appear in public without fear of arrest on cohabitation charges. Heber had been courting his second wife, Augusta, for an extended period of time. February 1884 journal revealed, quote, "A day long to remember. This evening I gave my decision in a matter that I had been considering for a long time. I feel that I had decided wisely and well," end quote. In her wedding day journal entry, she considered this, quote, "the most beautiful day of my life," end quote. Like Heber's first wife, Augusta was a schoolteacher. Not able to disclose her marriage to the apostle, her outwardly life changed very little. She continued to teach near her Pleasant Grove home while Heber lived with Lucy in Salt Lake. Life as an unrecognized wife was emotionally challenging for the newlywed. Her September 2, 1884 journal entry states, quote, "Attended conference here in Provo in the afternoon. Saw Apostle Francis M. Lyman. I'm glad to see him because he reminds me of someone else who I cannot see or even mention. I cried and cried after I'd gone to bed. I'm afraid I felt rather rebellious for a time, but I got over it," end quote. While secretly married to Grant, Augusta pursued her education by attending Tippinogus Academy, now known as BYU, then reverting back to the teaching profession until the necessary funds were once again available to obtain her education, eventually graduating in 1877 from what would later become the University of Utah. Augusta was a rare Utah woman with an advanced degree. After 4 years as Heber's secret wife, Augusta became pregnant, and once the pregnancy showed, she was forced into hiding. Quote, "There's been a great change in my life," she lamented. "I am truly on the underground. Though I do not wish to complain and am deeply thankful for the cause that led me here, yet many things are trying in the extreme. I have a comfortable place to stay, but the thought that I am virtually a prisoner makes me very sad, and I spend many hours in tears," end quote. At the time when expected mothers should be aglow, Augusta's loneliness was clear. Quote, "I have received many tokens of my dear husband's love and kindness, though to think that he cannot always see me when he is in the same town seems cruel. Everyone says, it is not wise, it is not wise, until I wish there was not a word as wise in the English language," end quote. Heber and Augusta's first and only child, Mary, was born in February 1889. Due to the Edmunds Tucker Act, women captured with offspring were deemed sufficient evidence to convict husbands of cohabitation. Accordingly, shortly thereafter, with Heber's financial support, baby and mother moved to first to New England and then to New York. Heber would visit Augusta when traveling east on church business, and on one of those visits, Heber brought Lucy and introduced the wives for the first time. When Augusta returned to Utah, she and Mary moved into her parents' Pleasant Grove home. Her time with Heber was minimal, usually limited to joining him on occasional church and business journeys, including an 1891 trip to Portland, Oregon. Joyce to have her precious daughter with her as a pillow wife, she nevertheless felt lonely and displaced. Quote, "There seems to be no place where I am needed," she lamented. "I am just a care that must be disposed of in some way," end quote. But with the death of Heber's first wife, Lucy, in January 1893, Augusta's life changed dramatically as Lucy and Heber's six children were left to Augusta's care. For the next decade, she and Heber lived together, raising the blended family. Unlike the late 1880s, when Grant's many businesses were flourishing, these years were financially trying. Following the financial panic in 1893, due to Grant's strained financial circumstances, neither of his wives had a home of their own, while at the same time his mother's house was mortgaged to assist with the many obligations. In 1901, Grant was called on to open a mission in Japan. During his tenure there, for both church and business reasons, it was necessary for him to return to Salt Lake in April 1902. Prior to departing once again to Japan, Grant used a highly personal reason to secure permission for Augusta to travel with him. Though his three wives had borne him a dozen children, Grant's only two sons had died in childhood. In the church's turn-of-the-century patriarchal society, the prospect of not having a male heir to his name and legacy was deeply distressing. He appealed to his superiors that Augusta will soon be past all hope of bearing a son unless in the near future we can be together, end quote. With her only child, Mary, having been born 13 years earlier, even this seemed a slim possibility. Augusta and Heber were companions in Japan for a year, attempting to preach the gospel in the new land. While Heber struggled mightily to learn the language, and really never did, Augusta seemed to pick it up quickly, having studied French most of her life. Heber, Augusta, and Mary spent a little over a year in Japan, returning to Salt Lake City in September 1903. Emily Wells, the daughter of revered church leader Daniel H. Wells and his pillar wife Martha, was only 5 months Heber's junior and had been a neighbor and childhood friend while he lived at his father's Main Street homestead. Yet in their late teens, the friendship faded over the subject of polygamy. A direct result of polygamous union notwithstanding, Emily adamantly refused to even consider marrying a man with polygamous desires. Nevertheless, years later, with Heber's impressive prominence in both the business and church community firmly established, Emily apparently softened to the idea. Although when Heber proposed to her in 1883, she denounced the proposition, a year later her softening was complete, and she became his third wife on May 27, 1884, a day after Heber's marriage to Augusta. Like Heber's marriage to Augusta, due to the anti-polygamy campaign, Emily's marriage was necessarily kept secret. When she became pregnant during her second year of marriage, she and Heber knew that the life on the underground was soon in store. Accordingly, to conceal the birth of her first child, it was decided that she should travel to England, where her father, Daniel H. Wells, was presiding over the European mission. In April 1886, Emily and Heber's first child, Desiree, was born in Liverpool mission headquarters. Although she missed her husband's companionship, Emily's life under her father's care was far superior to living on the Utah underground, and she took the opportunity to travel and enjoy the English culture. She attended plays and visited Shakespeare's birthplace. Emily stayed in England almost 2 years. When she returned to Utah, and she fled on the so-called open underground, moving from place to place through northern Utah and southern Idaho, including seclusion in a specially constructed hidden apartment in her mother's house. In November 1889, with now a second daughter in the family, Emily's 3-year-old Desiree and 11-month-old Grace relocated to join a number of plural wives 500 miles from Salt Lake City in the south-central Colorado town of Manassa. With federal pressure mounting, Manasseh had become a haven for polygamous families. The Mormon widows, as they were called, included the wives of Francis M. Lyman, John Morgan, B.H. Roberts, John Henry Smith, Moses Thatcher, and a number of plural wives of prominent Utah businessmen and church leaders. The trip to Manasseh required extreme caution. Heber took an earlier train, trusting Emily and his two daughters safe passage in the hands of friends. Although Heber purchased a home for his third family and provided items for physical comfort, Emily never warmed to the rustic Manasseh life. While fighting isolation, wind, and defending herself against the bedbugs were, in themselves, formidable challenges, she, like many women, longed for something greater than an occasional spousal reunion. Quote, "I have got everything in the house that I want," Emily penned to Heber, "except you," end quote. Over the next year and a half, Heber visited Emily five times at Manasseh and met her once in Denver. Certainly, he would have liked to have made more than an occasional visit, but juggling various business enterprises, church responsibilities, and with wife Lucy in Salt Lake and Augusta in New York, magnifying his husbandly duties to the satisfaction of all was impossible. Heber admitted to himself his frustration and the need of running all over the country to visit his families rather than having them all located near him in Salt Lake. While in Manasseh, Emily learned of Wilford Woodruff's 1890 manifesto. Her initial response on reading that manifesto, that the manifesto banned future plural marriages, seemed optimistic, perhaps hoping that the manifesto would allow her life to gain some normalcy. She wrote to Heber, quote, "I felt like rejoicing, and I seemed to see the first ray of light I've ever seen for us through our difficulties. You know I believe so devoutly in you, sweetheart, that things done by the authorities, which I perhaps do not understand, do not try me as they might were I married to a mere mortal," end quote. Yet the implication still proved troubling to her. Why had plural marriage, the principle for which she had spent years on the lam as a fugitive, been suspended? While Heber assured her that no plural marriages would be repudiated, they both realized that the manifesto was no redemption from life on the underground. Nevertheless, Grant sensed her desperate emotional state and agreed to have her return to Salt Lake. At the time, neither knew that she was once again pregnant and within months would need a new underground retreat. But in reality, following the manifesto, federal pressure gradually decreased and plural families were allowed to more openly join everyday society. And in the 1890s, Emily was able to raise her family in a more stable environment. Over the next few years, two more daughters and a son were born. But this decade also produced sorrow when, in 1895, Heber and Emily's then three-year-old son, Daniel, died of pneumonia. Soon after returning from his mission to Japan, Grant was called to replace Francis M. Lyman as president of the European mission. Prior to his departure, Grant obtained church president Joseph F. Smith's permission to bring his family with him. Grant's European mission presidency from 1903 to 1906 finally gave him, Emily, and their girls the chance to live together as a family. Augusta and Mary had been with him in Japan. Now it was Emily's turn. With a family nanny in tow, Emily was able to travel extensively with Heber with little worry about the girls. These were times of joy, Emily being able to sightsee while Heber conducted meetings and interviews. For the first time in her life, Emily felt truly liberated from the worries surrounding polygamy. She and Heber had each other to themselves, and in this, the 19th year of their marriage, felt an intimacy not previously achieved. Near the end of his mission, Grant received permission to take a final sightseeing tour into Italy. 23 days alone with Heber, exploring the wonders of Venice, Rome, and the Italian countryside was, for Emily, marital bliss. The time in Europe was the culmination of her marital relationship with Heber. As they sailed from Liverpool to Utah in 1906, little did they know that Emily was ill with undiagnosed stomach cancer. The mother of four daughters and a son who had died when he was four, Emily passed away in May 1908, her funeral held on the 27th, which would have been Heber and Emily's 24th anniversary. With Emily's death, Augusta remained Heber's only living wife. The couple lived together for the next 37 years, totaling 61 years of marriage. Following Heber's death in 1945, Augusta passed away 7 years later. There is an epilogue, and I have a few minutes, and I hope it's okay to go ahead and just proceed. Over his lifetime, Grant's position with regards to polygamy shifted 180 degrees. Both prior and subsequent to his call to the apostleship in 1882, Grant adamantly supported the institution of polygamy, becoming a pluralist himself in 1884. Of course, he was in good company, following the lead of nearly all church leaders more senior than himself. One might ask, did Grant's position change after the 1890 manifesto? Apparently not, and neither did the majority of other church general authorities. With the exception of Lorenzo Snow, who cohabitated only with his youngest wife, following the manifesto, not a single apostle or member of the First Presidency discontinued cohabitation relationships with their plural wives. In fact, in August 1891, First Presidency Counselor Joseph F. Smith responded specifically to Grant's question about the manifesto was whether the manifesto was a revelation, answered no. Smith explained that he regarded the document as inspired given the conditions imposed by the government on the church, but he did not believe it to be an emphatic revelation from God abolishing plural marriage. Although Grant had children by only one wife after 1890, he pled guilty to a charge of unlawful cohabitation in 1899 and was fined $100. During the post-manifesto period, Grant urged his best friend Anthony W. Ivins to become a polygamist. Grant warned his cousin that unless he entered into the principle, the two were unlikely to be associated together in the celestial kingdom. And Grant reminded others that Woodruff had clearly stated that the manifesto did not apply to cohabitation with earlier wives, and that, quote, he would see the Gentiles' opponent's damnation in hell before he would agree to cease living with his wives or advise any other person to do so, end quote. Although Grant's three wives had given birth to 12 children, only two had been boys, and both had died in childhood. Grant desperately wanted his son to carry on his name and legacy. In a moment of indiscretion, he even declared, quote, I am a lawbreaker. My wives have brought me only daughters. I propose to marry until I get wives who will bring me sons, end quote. At least four apostles took new plural wives during Snow's term as church president. In the late 1890s and early 20th century, Grant sought permission from both Lorenzo Snow and Joseph F. Smith to marry a plural wife. Before Grant's departure for a mission to Japan in 1901, he felt that Snow had intimated to him that he could take an additional wife. Snow told Grant at a meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency not to worry about the fact that he only had daughters and was unable to acquire another wife to remedy his circumstances. The Lord, he said, would make him rich in due time. But before acting on this, Grant eventually decided that Snow had withdrawn this permission. He also reportedly sought permission from President Joseph Smith to marry Fanny Woolley as a post-manifesto plural wife. Understanding Grant's desire for a male heir, George F. Gibbs, secretary of the president, Joseph F. Smith, wrote to Grant in England, giving it as his sentiment that Smith approved of post-manifesto plural marriages. Grant's later recollection to Smith was that, quote, your secretary gave me to understand that I was a fool, having no sons and with a great city of Liverpool in which to hide a wife if I did not get one. I had just come home from a mission and took it for granted that he knew what he was talking about, end quote. As late as March 1906, in support of post-manifesto polygamous apostles Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor, in a letter to Reed Smoot, Grant wrote from Liverpool that, quote, it is my earnest and constant prayer that brothers Taylor and Cowley might be preserved from the shafts of the enemy, end quote. But after Grant's return from England, when even following Joseph F. Smith's 1904 so-called Second Manifesto, polygamous unions continued, and when charges in the Salt Lake Tribune began appearing in 1909, publishing no less than 19 articles describing new polygamous marriages since 1890, a committee consisting of apostles Francis M. Lyman, John Henry Smith, and Heber J. Grant was organized to investigate the new polygamy charges and to consider what to do. The work of the committee eventually came to involve the entire quorum. During the autumn and winter of 1910 and 1911, individuals thought guilty of post-manifesto polygamous contraction were brought before the apostles in question. Soon, under pressure from Reed Smoot, church leadership agreed to quietly remove men who had married after 1890 from positions of visibility in church organizations. Additionally, with few exceptions, the quorums began excommunicating those involved in post-1904 plural marriages more vigorously than any time previous. By this time, two of Grant's wives had passed away, and he was now a de facto monogamist. Despite his earlier belief in and practice of the doctrine of plurality of wives, after succeeding Joseph F. Smith in 1918 as the church's president, he moved harshly against those seeking to continue the principle. And although he had been a pluralist himself, Grant moved against those found to be contracting such unions with greater sharpness than any predecessor. Grant seemed to blot from his memory the earlier solemn commitment Mormonism had displayed towards plurality. When avid anti-polygamist J. Reuben Clark joined the First Presidency in April 1933, he was quickly given the assignment to oversee the campaign against the so-called fundamentalists. Clark soon penned a document issued by the First Presidency and released later that year aimed directly at the fundamentalists, but was clearly not based on fact. The message erroneously claimed that it was not until 1874 that the federal government attempted to suppress polygamy. It also asserted that the church had, after all, made a compact with the government promising to cease plural marriages. It affirmed the manifesto was unanimously sustained. It claimed that Joseph F. Smith's official statement was precipitated by the misbehavior of just a few misguided members. The document held that President John Taylor's alleged 1886 revelation and authority for secret perpetuation of the practice were without historical archival evidence, and it reasserted that celestial marriage was not the same thing as plural marriage. There is no doubt that the document's purpose was to denounce groups in the church seeking to perpetuate polygamy, and that it was part of a larger campaign to quash such activity. For Grant, on a personal note, the 1933 statement insisted that he, neither presently nor in the past, had ever broken his pledge taken at the time of the manifesto to the church and to the world and to our government. But Grant had forgotten his imprudent remarks before a local judicial officer that he had no intention of honoring the law or keeping the promises agreed to by his signature to the amnesty petition, and he had lost all recollection that he had pleaded guilty in court to unlawful polygamous cohabitation. What might explain Grant's evolution from polygamist in both thought and deed to avid monogamist and anti-polygamist? Certainly times had changed. Grant had been in the church's senior quorums quite literally from the horse and buggy era to the era of passenger airplanes. He had joined the leading councils of the church at a time when the term Mormon had become synonymous with all that was absurd in religion, impure in social life, or disloyal to the government, primarily due to the church's policy on polygamy. As a prominent church leader and polygamist, Grant had experienced the difficulties firsthand. During the 1890s, on a number of occasions, he was charged with unlawful cohabitation, arrested once, and his parole wife spent years hiding from the federal authorities. Mormonism's public relations problems in Utah were troubling enough, but Grant had also experienced three major episodes which solidified in his mind the importance of improving the church's perception to outsiders. The first was a financial panic of 1893 when Grant was forced to travel to financial centers in the East in the pursuit of loans from Gentile financiers necessary for the church's temporal survival. Additionally, his mission experience in both Japan and Europe awakened him to the damage Mormonism's bad reputation could have on missionary efforts. European experience, coinciding with the Smoot hearings in the U.S. Congress, exposed Grant, even in faraway London, to the sensational folly made of the polygamy issue. Even Grant himself was attacked in the press, accused of leaving Salt Lake City hastily to avoid unlawful cohabitation charges, the paper's goal being to embarrass the church and Smoot just prior to the Senate hearings. The weight of these experiences fed Grant's anxiety regarding the church's image. Just how important was maintaining the church's image to Grant? During his first conference address after becoming church president, he spoke at length of how the church was perceived by both friend and foe. And commenting on the positive press given to the Mormons became a regular part of Grant's public speeches. The world had changed since the days of Utah's political, social, and religious isolation. While important at the time in creating a peculiar people, in but not of the world, to spread the gospel message, a new paradigm was now required. And while once Mormons who practiced polygamy sat at the apex of religious valor, its usefulness had not only faded, but had now long since become a burden. Its eradication as part of Mormonism theology and history became not only an institutional objective, it became his objective as well. Paraphrasing George Orwell in 1984, he who controls the past controls the future. Thanks.
I forgot to mention that Dan has written a very fine book, As a Thief in the Night, The Mormon Quest for Millennial Deliverance. Okay, and now very quickly, I'm going to go through some of these slides. We've already seen pictures of the John Taylor plural wives. And part of this, I won't take any time to talk about Joseph F. Smith's plural wives, but he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plural wives. His first wife, Levira A.C. Smith, was his full cousin, and this marriage did not work out. They had a divorce. And so throughout his life, he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 plural wives. Okay, and now we'll take a look at some of what they looked like. This is Phoebe Carter Woodruff, Wilford's first wife, as a young woman and then as an older woman. This is Emma Smoot Smith, and remember, she was his second public wife after Phoebe died. She would travel with him. And there's a nice shot of them together. Mary Ann Jackson Woodruff Ross, remember, she was his first plural wife.